Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Today for Tuesday, October 20th. I'm Bill Scanlon. It's 2 weeks to Election Day. It's also the deadline day set by Speaker Nancy Pelosi for a COVID relief bill deal with the White House. More in a moment. First, a quick look at news headlines. The Justice Department today announced charges against Google, alleging that the company maintains monopolies in the search and search-based ad markets through anti-competitive and exclusionary practices. DOJ was joined in the suit by 11 states' attorneys general, an effort that marks the largest antitrust effort in decades against a high-tech company. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn told CNN this morning, quote, "I think there's still an outside chance something will get done before the elections, but the window is closing." He was referring to negotiations between Speaker Pelosi and the White House on a COVID relief package and a 48-hour deadline dictated by the Speaker on Sunday. The Senate, meanwhile, is headed toward votes to advance the GOP coronavirus relief legislation. That vote could come tomorrow. The Washington Post reports this afternoon early voting counts suggest a record level of civic participation nationwide before Election Day. The tens of millions of ballots already cast show highly enthusiastic voters are making sure their votes are counted amid a pandemic. President Trump holds a rally this evening in Erie, Pennsylvania. First Lady Melania Trump had been expected to accompany the president, but she reportedly has a lingering cough. Stephanie Grisham, the First Lady's chief of staff, said that, quote, "out of an abundance of caution, she will not be traveling today." The last time the First Lady was seen in public was on September 29th at the first presidential debate. She and the president were diagnosed with COVID-19 October 2nd. The president's rally streams live tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern, at cspan.org. Larry Kudlow, White House economic advisor, this morning talked about the COVID relief negotiations he spoke about with reporters and said that the president is seeking, quote, a smart, targeted package.
So all right. Will there be a COVID deal today?
I don't know. No forecast. I can't make a forecast. President wants a deal. He wants the key areas, though. That's the point. It's not top-line numbers. You know, PPP small business, we should have done this months ago with $135 billion still unspent. Unemployment assistance, no one acted from Congress. The president had an executive order to help out. That money's not forever. It's going to run out. We should have a bill targeted to unemployment assistance. The president likes the direct mail checks. He's willing to go even further than the Democrats, things of that sort. The airlines need help. That's a high priority. The schools need help. COVID-related repairs and renovations. That's a high priority. But there's a number of political and ideological points in that have nothing to do with COVID. And we don't want to go that direction. If it's targeted right, absolutely. If it's not, not going to work.
Well, one of the obstacles
to get there is that Republicans are not willing to go that far.
I haven't seen you in ages. Ages. Nice to see you. Well, I don't know. I don't want to speculate because, again, I think a well-targeted, smart package will win Republican support. And I think the president can be very persuasive on that. And mind you, he's working with Senator McConnell and the others all the time, along with Secretary Mnuchin and the Chief Mark Meadows. So, you know, I wouldn't say that. We have to wait and see what the product is.
But Larry, it's been months. Why should we realistically expect that 2 weeks before the election there's going to be a deal to find for the president for persuasion? Wouldn't that have been about 4, 5, 6 months ago? It seems like he decided he wants to be the one to walk away. And this is Peter.
Since mid-July, we have put our cards on the table for these targeted areas. We have. We've been very clear about that. And we've come a long way in the negotiations. So, here's the thing. I just go back to this issue of targeted assistance. I just today did not understand why we couldn't have had separate bills, standalones for these key areas. There's money that should be repurposed and re-legislated that was never spent. Simple, easy stuff where there's bipartisan support. But once it became a mammoth bill with a lot of ideological asks in it, that's what hurt. We've stayed on economic assistance, targeted assistance. We're always for it, and COVID-related.
With negotiations underway this afternoon between the Speaker and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and votes ahead in the Senate on a GOP plan. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would take up a White House Democratic agreement if that deal clears the U.S. House.
Leader McConnell, does your skinny bill contain another round of stimulus checks for all Americans?
No, it doesn't. But it does address an awful lot of things that we do agree on. And I don't think the fact that those checks are not a part of this package, as others have said, is a good argument for not doing what we are laying on the floor, most of which is completely without controversy.
Why did you decide not to include another round of stimulus checks?
We thought about $500 billion was appropriate for at this juncture. No one would argue the economy is in good shape, but it's noteworthy that unemployment's about 8.4%, which is what it was in several years during the Obama first term. We clearly have way too many people unemployed, and we do continue the plus-up of unemployment insurance.
I just want to clarify something you said earlier first. You said that if Pelosi and Mnuchin do reach an agreement, that you will consider the legislation. Does that mean bringing it to the floor?
Well, if a presidentially supported bill clears the House, at some point we'll bring it to the floor, yes.
And has the president asked you to move forward on that or to support it and to get your members to support it?
We'd have to see what it was first. There's been no deal announced. If a deal is announced, then it'll have to be written. Then people will have a chance to take a look at it. Then it'll have to clear the House. And if all of that occurs, of course, we would consider it in the Senate.
Are you personally, he's talking about a price tag of $1.8 trillion. He says he must go higher than $2.2 trillion. Are you personally, Senator, comfortable with spending that amount of money?
Well, what I'm telling you is that if such a deal were to clear the House, obviously with a presidential signature promised, we would put it on the floor of the Senate and let the Senate consider it.
Also today, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Democratic leadership also briefed reporters this afternoon. Leader Schumer called Republicans' most recent COVID relief efforts and votes happening today in the Senate a, quote, stunt, and that Senate Democrats are making a real effort to bring to the Senate floor the HEROES Act II bill, which recently passed the House.
Our country is in enormous pain. We've had 220,000 people die. Millions sick, the numbers going up who get sick. 6 million Americans missed their rent payment last month. Millions are losing their jobs. Small businesses are going under left and right. We have so many different problems. And what do the Republicans do, Leader McConnell? A stunt. They can't get anything done. Their caucus is divided. Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans are the major barrier to preventing us from getting a bill. Because even when Mnuchin calls them up, they say they're not going to do anything. What was really indicative of what happened was what happened at the Appropriations Committee. Pelosi said, well, our number's 143. Mnuchin says we can get up to 119. So they decided to have the appropriators get together. The Republican appropriator said, our instructions are to start at zero. We don't have any other instructions. So when the American people are suffering, to put this political stunt on the floor a second time is cruel, is harsh, and it shows a complete lack of leadership and caring for the suffering of the American people. Now, what are we doing? We are making an effort to bring to the floor the HEROES II bill, the bill that passed the House, that would have a realistic chance of helping people. And it has many things in it that are not in either bill that is being brought up today and tomorrow by the Republican Senate stunt. Let me remind you what they are, or some of them. We're going to focus on three here. One is health care. We need more testing. We need more tracing. The HEROES bill has $75 billion, and more important even than the money is a plan laid out to how to do it because the administration's been incompetent. We gave the money last time. Do you know $9 billion is still sitting there for the states to do tracing, and they haven't even distributed it yet, even though it was passed in the original CARES bill? So we need money for testing and tracing, but we need money for our hospitals, the doctors and nurses and healthcare workers. We can't leave them behind. We need money for patients who are sick. None of that. First area, healthcare, testing and helping our healthcare institutions and helping the American people when they need healthcare. Second is schools. We need our schools to reopen safely. Safely. Everyone wants to reopen them. We cannot leave our school children behind. We cannot leave our teachers behind and those who work in the schools, nor can we leave all the parents behind who have jobs at work, but if their kids aren't in school, what are they going to do? And the third area we're focusing on today is small business. This PPP bill leaves out so much that the HEROES bill has in it. No targeted aid for restaurants. No targeted aid for stages. No targeted aid for minority businesses. No targeted aid for local news media, critical access hospitals, and nonprofits. No idle money. The money probably that smaller businesses use easiest of all because it's a grant.
We are joined by Billy House, who's congressional correspondent for Bloomberg News. Let's start with the speaker. Nancy Pelosi was on Bloomberg TV earlier today. What did she say?
Well, regarding stimulus, she was very optimistic and was pointing to a 3 o'clock Tuesday phone call with the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, which she depicted as sort of the way that they could put their final some final things on the table and iron out some wrinkles toward perhaps a deal on a stimulus measure, a comprehensive one, and one that could even be written in text bill form by the end of the week and voted on next week. She had said that that's not decided, but she was very hopeful.
What are some of those details in general or specifically things that Democrats have to have? What does the White House want specifically? Sticking points?
Well, right off the bat, state and local funding has been a real bugaboo as more money for localities battling and paying first responders and other employees to battle coronavirus has been a big point for Democrats in the House to push for. Over in the Senate, though, and in Republicans in the House as well, kind of depict this as a blank check bailout effort to bring municipalities who have overspent over time a way to pay for those things that may not be even related to coronavirus. So that's the other thing. And then Mitch McConnell's demands for liability protection, blanket almost for businesses, has been something Democrats have opposed. They rather strengthen OSHA regulations to help workers.
As we do this interview, the Senate is voting this afternoon. They're voting on providing additional PPP funding for small businesses. This is ahead of Wednesday's procedural vote on the Republican COVID-19 plan. What's the purpose on these votes if they're going to take up a broader Republican plan in the Senate on Wednesday?
Well, the PPP is a standalone to help small businesses. It's one of the two, and you're correct, messaging bills that Senate Majority Leader McConnell is bringing to the floor. And that's exactly the purpose. It's a messaging effort that'll likely be blocked by Democrats, as the larger $500 billion bill will be blocked Wednesday. However, they want to say that they're trying to get something done. Democrats in the Senate are blocking that. And by the way, when getting something done, that doesn't mean we have to do a $2 trillion bill, even if the president suggests he's on board with that idea.
I was going to say his other message, at least to reporters in briefings today, was that the Republican leader would take up a Democratic agreement with the White House if it passes the House. But time is running out, correct?
Time is running out. I mean, just Pelosi acknowledges that bill language can't be written over in the House till probably completed at the end of the week, even if they were to agree now as we talk. And that members would have to be brought back, and then you'd have to go to the Senate where there's opposition. I mean, 13 Republican senators could block this thing from advancing. There's also questions about what exactly Senate Majority Leader McConnell said in a lunch today to his members. Some reporting is that he was suggesting he didn't really want this to happen before election, if at all.
Well, that's my last question for you is that, aside from the critical areas that many of these measures address what is the political necessity of passing a bill 2 weeks before Election Day or a week before Election Day, as the case may be?
Well, I think it comes down perhaps a lot to individual lawmakers who are running for re-election. Some in the Senate are, and all the House members are, and just what circumstances are perhaps in their districts economically. There's certainly also some Democrats in the House who are in purple districts, may have many freshmen in districts that were won by Trump, and they certainly have been among those pushing for some sort of relief. And then there are areas of the country that have been hit particularly hard. As for Republicans, they've seen in some of their races that weren't supposed to be contested suddenly become pretty close, and some recalculation there whether or not maybe they should do some stimulus too.
Billy House covers Congress for Bloomberg News. Bloomberg.com is where you read his reporting. Also on Twitter at House in Session. Billy House, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
And back to Senate business. The majority leader in his briefing earlier said the Senate will vote next Monday on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to be Associate Justice on the Supreme Court.
With regard to the Supreme Court justices, I think you've already written, we'll be voting to confirm Justice to be Barrett next Monday. And I think that will be another signature accomplishment in our effort to put on the courts, the federal courts, men and women who believe in the quaint notion that maybe the job of the judge is to actually follow the law.
You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. More in just a moment. Checking the markets, after being up nearly 300 points, the stock market ended the day on an optimistic note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 113.37.4% overall, and at 28,308.79. The S&P gaining 0.5%, the NASDAQ up 3%. CNBC reports that shares of Carnival Corporation, American Airlines rising 3.3% and 1.9% respectively, as company groups that would benefit the most from the economy reopening. And leading the way today, Kohl's jumping 6.6%, they report, and Nordstrom ahead 1.2%. In his morning phone call today with Fox and Friends, President Donald Trump continued to criticize Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease doctor, following Dr. Fauci's 60 Minutes appearance Sunday. The president insisted he gets along with Dr. Fauci, while also complaining that the doctor, who has clashed with him at times over the coronavirus, is not, quote, a team player.
No, I get along with him very well. He's a Democrat. He's actually a very good friend of the Cuomo family. But he's been there for a long time. I leave him there. And he's a nice guy. But he's been wrong. First of all, he said, don't wear masks. Very strong. I'm sure you have that clip. He said, don't wear masks. He said many things. He said, let the people from China that are heavily infected, let them come in. He admits that he was wrong on that, and he admits that I saved thousands of lives. And it's good if people trust him, but it's not that the people, reporters like him because they think he's against me. He's not really against me, but he did say something that we kept him off television, and yet we allowed him to do 60 Minutes the other night. He couldn't do it without our approval. So how do we keep him off television? But by the way, do 60 Minutes. Look, he's a nice guy. He's got a really bad arm, not a good baseball thrower, but he's a nice guy. The only thing I say is he's a little bit sometimes not a team player, but he is a Democrat, and I think that he's just fine. It's a view. We have other. Scott Atlas is fantastic, but they go after him so much. He has a different view. By the way, everybody has a different view. Different views on everything. Doesn't mean they're wrong or they're bad people, but people have different views.
But to be clear,
and
Mr. President,
ultimately I make the decisions.
Of course.
And we've saved millions of lives by the decisions I've made. We closed up our country in the midst of the greatest economic boom in history and saved millions of lives. Now it's opening. So we did the right thing. And we're doing much better than Europe, and we're doing much better than everyone else. And our recovery is the strongest in the world.
But to be clear, Mr. President, are you and Dr. Fauci at odds? You said you are not.
No,
but you
I'm
also
not at odds. I like him. I think he's a terrific guy.
And the president's disagreements with Dr. Fauci came up on Capitol Hill. Senate Majority Leader McConnell responded to questions.
Leader McConnell, is it appropriate for the president to continue attacking Dr. Fauci in the way that he has recently?
Well, one thing they both agree on is that shutting down the economy again is not a good idea. And as you guys have heard me say repeatedly since the 1st of May, the one thing we all need to do is wear our mask, practice social distancing, try to prevent the spread. It's clear that we're having a second round of surge. And the only thing each of us can do until we get a vaccine is to act as responsibly as possible. That's what I and my members are doing. That's why the Senate's been in session since the 1st of May. Thanks.
Do you have confidence in Dr. Fauci? Leader McConnell, do you have confidence in Dr. Fauci?
Also in Washington today, Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza talked about the 2020 elections. She spoke about Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court and about race relations. She said 2020 would be, quote, one of the most consequential elections in a generation. The discussion was moderated by Washington Post senior critic at large, Robin Given.
How are you feeling about the election these days?
You know, today on this Tuesday, I'm feeling motivated and inspired.
At this hour.
Look, this is going to be one of the most consequential elections in a generation. And what I know is that already millions of people are voting and have voted. And from what I understand, this election will have the highest turnout in the history of this nation. So that inspires me and makes me hopeful, because I think what it indicates is that people are paying attention and that people are taking their protest into the polls. And that is important because elections are a organizing terrain that too many movements leave on the table. And what I always say, and I get this from my mom, is that, you know, anything you leave on the table, you're leaving for someone else to eat. And most likely somebody who is being opportunistic is going to take what you've left and try to use it for their own agenda. And so for me, the way that I feel about this election is we need to get through it and we need to do what we got to do. I dropped off my mail-in ballot yesterday. I demanded my sticker. I was so proud of it. Right? Going on this week, I was like, I am making time to do this. And there are Black women like me across this nation that are doing exactly the same thing, trying to hold their families together, trying to make sure that they can keep a job and keep a roof over their head, and they're making sure that they're going to be a part of the political process. I think Black folks across the nation are saying no more decisions should be made about us without us. Now, with that being said, I talk a lot in the book about, you know, how voting can be a movement, but I also talk about some of the failures of both parties to address adequately or even at all the concerns that our communities have. You know, my organization, the Black Futures Lab, we work to make Black communities powerful in politics. We conducted the largest survey of Black people in America in 155 years. We learned a lot about the things important to Black folks. We developed a Black agenda for 2020. 60,000 Black voters have signed on to that agenda, and they're using it as they're making decisions up and down the ballot. The most important part of that process was that we heard most frequently that nobody ever asks us what we care about, what we experience every day, and what we want to see for our futures. And that does not bode well for a vibrant, functioning democracy. So we've got work to do. We have to keep pushing these parties to make sure that they're not just using us symbolically, but that there is some substance in relationship to the agenda that they will be organized around, not just for 4 years, but indefinitely.
That's Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza. Just a reminder, all of our C-SPAN coverage available at cspan.org. It is 2 weeks to Election Day, 2 days to the final presidential debate. And Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel said today she hopes the Commission on Presidential Debates, quote, does not exist after the 2020 election, accusing the commission of engaging in, quote, election interference with its new rule for the upcoming debate. On the commission's decision to mute the microphone of whoever is not supposed to be talking during the next presidential debate on Thursday, Ms. McDaniel claimed the commission is, quote, stacked against President Donald Trump and in favor of Democratic nominee Joe Biden. She appeared earlier today on Fox News.
Well, of course, the president's going to debate. He looks forward to getting in front of the American people and debating Joe Biden. But he's right. This commission has been stacked against him from day one. It's part of the corruption that we've seen in Washington. They don't like Donald Trump. This is a city that's, plugged in for Joe Biden. And to have this supposed nonpartisan commission continue to make rule changes without consulting the Trump campaign, break promises that they made to the Trump campaign, to unilaterally make decisions that ended the second debate, it's just really shameful, and they're hurting the American people, and it is a form of election interference. I hope this commission does not exist after this. I certainly don't consider them nonpartisan. They do not deserve that status, and they have not worked on behalf of the Republican Party because you have a bunch of never-Trumpers on that commission. And you know who said that best? Bob Dole. I mean, Bob Dole's not a flamethrower. He's somebody who speaks the truth, and he said, I know all these people, and I think this has not been a good process.
That was RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel earlier today on Fox News. A reminder, you can watch the entire debate this Thursday evening and listen to it here on C-SPAN Radio. Our coverage begins at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Listen to it on radio, and you can find it online as well at cspan.org. As we mentioned earlier, the Justice Department today filed an antitrust lawsuit against Google, alleging the company is abusing its dominance over smaller rivals. It's the federal government's most significant legal action in more than two decades to confront a technology giant's power. Justice Department lawyers accuse Google of illegally using its monopoly to stifle competition and hurt consumers through exclusionary agreements, including deals like the one it struck with Apple, making Google the default search engine on the Safari browser on iPhones. Justice officials say Google's spending profits, made from its powerful position to buy special treatment for its search engine on devices and web browsers, created what the department says is a, quote, self-reinforcing cycle of monopoly power abuse. Earlier today, Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen spoke on a call with reporters about the lawsuit.
Google is the gateway to the Internet and a search advertising behemoth. Google achieved some success in its early years, and no one begrudges that. But as the antitrust complaint filed today explains, it has maintained its monopoly power through exclusionary practices that are harmful to competition.
This afternoon, we spoke with Russell Brandom, policy editor with The Verge, and asked him what DOJ hopes to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the big questions, especially since a lot of what they're alleging has, you know, this is something that the European Union has also taken on. In Europe, what that resulted with was new restrictions on the way Google can basically bundle Google services in Android. So, you know, do you want to have Gmail pre-installed necessarily on Android? Do you want to have Google search necessarily sort of built in? That seems like a likely outcome, but, you know, in the calls today, they said, well, the remedy is up to the courts. We believe that this is anti-competitive conduct, and I think certainly everyone on the antitrust side is saying if this just ends in a monetary fine, it'll be a huge loss. But it may be something that ultimately the judge puts together. We're not sure where this is going to end up still.
Back this up for a second. Maybe give us the 30 or 45 second snapshot of how did Google's search business and search-based ad business evolve to this point of such market dominance?
Yeah. So the thing that, you know, in the 90s, Google sort of created their search engine, which I think was a significant technical advance over what was happening at the time. And one of the big innovations of it is the previous search engines, everything had been on the front page. So you went to Yahoo.com or you went to Alta Vista, and there was all this sort of other stuff that you had to, you know, was right next to the search bar because they figured this was their opportunity. Google, they put everything on the results page. And so they started giving these sort of targeted results, targeted ads. And so they really focused on that real estate. And to this day, you know, Google.com, if you go there, it's mostly empty space, something they're very proud of. One of the points that the indictment focuses on a lot is this shift to mobile. So now the majority of web searches happen from mobile devices, basically from phones. This was a real turning point in the industry, and it's easy to imagine some other sort of competing service, Microsoft Bing, maybe Apple decides to launch a search engine, coming in and saying, we're going to be the best mobile search engine. Google is good on desktop, but you know, when we get to phones, it's going to work differently and we're going to edge them out. In order to prevent that from happening and stay in a dominant position, Google really leveraged Android and it really leveraged Chrome. So Android being the mobile operating system, Chrome being the browser.
Right.
It tied both of those products in very closely with Google search. And I think, you know, the big claim that the Department of Justice is putting forward is saying, you know, was that anti-competitive? Were they using their position as a dominant market player to ensure that no other mobile browser could sort of sneak in?
Okay, one more history question, I promise you. Are there any parallels here, any parallels here between this and the nationwide dominance of the Bell telephone system before its breakup in the 1970s?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, you know, a lot of antitrust folks will tell you that there is. Tim Wu has written a ton about this at Columbia. It's very tricky. I think the basic argument for the Bell telephone system being a monopoly was that they had control of all of this infrastructure. And, you know, it didn't make sense to build an entire other phone network to compete with Bell telephone. You would never be able to afford it just to sort of get a second competitor. So everything was tending towards there only being one of these major national phone networks. Now, there are these other search engines, and the question of why people don't use them is really at the heart of this. So, you know, when you get to Google's response to the Department of Justice, they're saying, look, we're not making anyone use Google search. The fact that most people use Google search is a result of their choices, and that's because we're working really hard to be the best search engine that we can possibly be. And so when, you know, you go to a search page and you say, oh, I can do Google, I can do Bing, I can do DuckDuckGo, I'm going to choose to do Google. Now, it's tricky, right? There's a lot going into that choice. There's a lot of defaults. There's a lot of deals happening. But I think that is an argument that Google can make today that Bell could not make when it was being broken up.
Lastly, we're looking at a process by the Department of Justice that's going to last years, not months, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you look at what happened with Microsoft especially, and that was there was this long, long process under the Clinton administration. And then when Bush came into office, they were much less interested in it and really backed off on a lot of some of the more aggressive, you know, remedies that would have literally broken up Microsoft. Now, you know, this is obviously happening under Trump. I think even if Trump wins a second term, it's plausible that this may go for 4 years. And, you know, the Department of Justice in 5 years is still going to be, you know, administering this case, even if they've won and they're talking about, you know, what Google has to do because they won. So, I mean, it really is the question of how much future administrations are going to want to force this issue is one of the really important factors that it's very hard to know.
And it means we'll be talking about it for several years to come. Russell Brandom, who's a policy editor with The Verge, read his reporting on this and other stories at TheVerge.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And back to campaign 2020. Finally this afternoon, a little something different in the Utah governor's race, an ad where the two contenders for the office are getting along. Spencer Cox and Chris Peterson, the Republican and Democratic nominees for Utah governor, are promising to respect each other and the outcome of the upcoming election. Today, they released a series of public service announcements urging Utah to be, quote, an example for the rest of the nation and not let partisanship overwhelm our politics. Here's one of those ads now running in Utah.
I'm Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other to be your next governor.
And while I think you should vote for me.
Yeah, but really you should vote for me.
There are some things we both agree on.
We can debate issues without degrading each other's character.
We can disagree without hating each other.
And win or lose, in Utah, we work together.
So let's show the country that there's a better way.
My name's Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
And
we approve this message.
And that's Washington Today for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. If you miss a program, you can find it by searching Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts, or go to our website at cspan.org/podcast. Thanks for being here.